everyone. Welcome back to Not About the Weather, episode 33. This is our March episode 2019, and we are here today with a special themed event talking about the Song of Ice and Fire series / Game of Thrones TV show, as we're just about to get into the final season of Game of Thrones on television, which has by now completely outstripped the pace of George R.R. Martin's books. So we thought that we would come and talk about this, as it's such an interesting phenomena in pop culture for a number of reasons that I'm sort of keen to talk about. If you've never listened to us before, if this is your first episode of Not About the Weather for whatever reason, either because you're here from a certain audience of the Game of Thrones fandom or another fandom or a Twitter account, we are a podcast that is pretty much about everything and nothing, general interest pop culture podcast, and we sort of skip the small talk. Not About the Weather refers to skipping the light water cooler conversation and going into big opinions about the things that we care about, no matter how life-affirming or mediocre or big picture or small picture they may be. We are talking about them in depth either way. This episode is hosted by myself, Natalie, and one of our other current and existing co-hosts, Ariana, and we have a special guest on the episode to join us, Meredith, who is one of the biggest Song of Ice and Fire fans I've ever met in my entire life, in a very intense way, and I'm very keen to hear about things from her perspective on how deep this fandom goes, basically, because I'm certainly my experience is, you know, we'll all talk about our experience with this property, but Meredith is a big time fan, and so very interested to talk about that. If you want to reach us in any way, our handle is at NATW Podcast. It's on Twitter. We have Instagram, Facebook, and then the Gmail account if you want to write something long form, natwpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow the podcast on Tumblr at notaboutthewetherpodcast.tumblr.com. And we are available on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and all of those places where you can listen to a podcast. I like Spotify because it means I don't have to have another app for things, but that is where you can find us. So just going around the room, my experience with this whole Game of Thrones property, I can't remember if I read the books first. It certainly wasn't far enough to predate it that the show was not in the stratosphere. It wasn't like a 1990s readership or something like that. It's definitely while I was working in a bookstore, I either started reading the books in advance of the show coming out or may have seen the first season and then got into the books. I've always been interested in them, but since then, but I find that the way that the, you know, short seasons of a TV show in between, you know, 1 or 2 years gaps is sort of hard to follow. Yeah, so my investment level is interest, but I do definitely hold more interest in the detail level in the books. Ariana, what is your experience with this whole thing?
So I'm not even really sure how I got interested in it. I feel like I must have heard people saying that the show was really good, but I knew it came from the book, so I really wanted to read the book first. So I read the first book first, and then I watched seasons 1 and 2. Maybe it was 2 seasons in already. Then I watched seasons 1 and 2 and then read the rest of the books before 3 came out.
Yeah. I certainly read the books. I breezed through the books fairly quickly, you know, given their length. And it would have certainly been within, before season 2 came out, I think I'd read all of the books. The way that this show and book has made a wider audience commit to that level of genre fiction, like high fantasy, is one of the most interesting things to me about its entire picture, because I've always been a fantasy fan, but it's certainly been something that, you know, I never really expected to see, like, random business women who probably read a high fantasy book, like, reading these books on the, you know, the train. So that's something about this whole phenomena that I'd kind of really like. But Meredith, tell us about your history with Song of Ice and Fire and with genre in general, I guess.
Such as it is.
Yeah.
So I, unlike you guys, I was not a book reader until after the first season of the show. And then it coincided with Dance of Dragons being released and, or A Dance with Dragons. I'm sorry. And, I just like fell down the rabbit hole. Basically. Mm-hmm. I lost like 6 months of my life to it after the first season. It was one of those like, wait a minute, you know, the story keeps going. I have to voraciously tear through everything associated with this. And then it's kind of, you know, the rabbit hole that never had a bottom for me. So that's, and now, and you know, I think there are, it's a really great fandom. There are a lot of people who can speak much more eloquently than I can in the books, and you know, I'll plug them at the end of this, but it's just been a hell of a lot of fun. And I was always a high fantasy reader, I mean, growing up, and I just don't quite know why I never got my hands on them before, but I hadn't. And it really did take season one. And coincidentally, actually, it coincided with me becoming a TV writer.
Okay.
And really seeing like what you could do in TV and the breadth and scope and scale that TV was tackling, and all the different characters and all the very exciting things we could do in television. And so it was kind of this like braiding together of all of my interests at the time in this really awesome way. So
I mean, what they are achieving is very interesting and continues to be very interesting now, with tackling like a property that has like such a huge source material and so many different paths, and to keep people kind of invested in all of these different paths, or like remember who was related to who, so why this matters and stuff like that. But I think that would have been around the same time that you mentioned. It must have been, because yes, I was working in bookselling, and I remember the release of Dance of Dragons, and my editions of the books are the editions that were re-released when Dance of Dragons came out. So it must have been that year as well. But it's just such a – yeah, I think that phenomenon of, you know, yes, I was a high fantasy reader, probably not this long, like, but I read a lot of fantasy. The biggest thing about these books that surprised me when I started reading them was the like the tone was not dry. Like it was not hard to read these incredibly long books. It was not hard for me to switch between characters. It was not hard for me to like understand the characters. The tone is very conversational, which I really like. But what's your perspective of the people who, I guess, like how this is kind of both as the show, like as the hot topic that everyone watches, and I guess people have adapted to reading the books, with, I guess, you know, people who weren't in fandoms or certainly weren't interested in stuff like genre, you know, fantasy, medieval, you know, royal histories, magic, that kind of stuff. Do you think that's opened up people to kind of learning about storytelling through genre?
I mean, I do. I also think that, you know, and George R. Martin says this, and I'm going to paraphrase him really, really badly, but it's something along the lines of like, you know, Lord of the Rings ends with essentially like, you know, Aragorn ruled wisely for 100 years.
Yeah.
And he was like, well, what was Aragorn's tax policy? And so I think that the combination of high fantasy and real politic is really appealing to a lot of people. And the fact that it obviously becomes very magical as you go on in the series, and obviously the prologue in all the books, but especially the first book is very magical, but it's not relying on that to tell its story.
No, it's not. Yeah, and magic isn't that much of an aspect. It's just sort of, you know, like a fantastically medieval. And I've always loved real medieval histories, or like fictionalizations of, you know, your Tudors and all of that kind of stuff. So for me, it hits a lot of marks, but it did surprise me in a positive way how much it's opened up people to genre, because I've always said about genre is that I feel like that you get the most human stories there, because the heightened element, the element of storytelling where you're like, oh, this is not a direct reflection of my life, is the world building, rather than like in a comedy, it's like really slapstick behavior or something like that. Genre, because the element that is kind of your suspension of disbelief is this world of magic or fantasy, or, you know, in whatever way, I find that those are the moments where you get people reacting the most human, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, and also it's just a well-told story. I mean, there's a reason why we've been rereading Chaucer and holding Shakespeare to our hearts. I mean, you know, like I just called Game of Thrones book Song of Ice and Fire Shakespeare. That's right. anytime you see a story that's being told with such care and such compassion for characters and it obviously goes to some really dark and nasty places, but life goes to some dark and nasty places. So I think that kind of transcends its genre-ness in a way.
Yeah.
I totally agree. I mean, I get kind of irritated when people are frustrated with how slow he writes, because to me, every chapter feels like a really well-told short story. And I'm like, this chapter alone probably took months to write. Mm-hmm. And so no wonder this is taking so long.
Mm-hmm.
I get frustrated with that too. And also the idea that like, I mean, guys, we've been waiting decades for these books.
Yeah.
It's okay. We can wait another year.
I think right now the reason that that kind of kicks up more is obviously because now people, if the show is ending, people feel like they're going to be spoiled for the very much end game of the books. And so I want Meredith to talk about, like, in the deeper fandom, because I would probably talk about this with people like Ariana or like my own Twitter followers. I don't think I'm in any like community specifically to discuss Game of Thrones. And I know
let me be clear. Like, I'm a grade A lurker in these communities. you know, I have a lot of people who I'm fans of whose meta I really like and a couple of podcasts that I think are really, really special. And, you know, if it's not cool to talk about them, like, I won't. But if it is cool, I think people who are interested in this should definitely check them out, because they're awesome. But I, you know, as somebody who is really, really fascinated with storytelling, obviously, just pulling these books, and as Ariana said, there's so much detail in every single one of these chapters that going through and pulling them apart, formally, structurally, from a character standpoint, it's all been really, really fun. For me. I think that the end of the series is going to be incredibly cathartic. I don't think it's going to be, it'll be different, I think, than what's going to happen. It has to be different than what's going to happen in the books.
That's the question. Yeah, that's the big question. Do the kids on the forum say that the show is going to be a different ending to the books? That's the really big question that I have.
Well, yeah, I think, I mean, I'll just say what my opinion is, and please guys, please. I think so. I mean, something like 5 years ago or I think 5 years ago, George and David and Dan sat down and George walked them through the ending and then some big plot goalposts along the way. And they've stuck to that, but like George has already changed his mind. I mean, we've seen it in some of the sample chapters that he's released. Things like Stannis Baratheon's character, for example, that I don't think there's any world in which like that character ends, goes out the way that character
went
out
on the show. Yeah.
And there are a lot of examples like that that seem really small, but I think will add up to, they will have to necessarily add up to a much different, not a much different, but a different ending. But I think it'll be like, you'll be able to, yes, lots of things will be the same too. So, but I don't think that'll rob us book readers of enjoyment.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that is kind of the interesting thing to think about going into season 8 of Game of Thrones, is whether basically whether that's going to create any kind of like, mixed feelings, I guess, about how it's all played out, about the length of time, you know, that the book there is between books, about whether, you know, one is right or one is wrong and all of that kind of stuff. I think that, you know, the world building is extreme. And there's just so many plot points in the books that I thought would be crucial to how the reclaiming of the throne by whoever it is plays out, that have not even come into the show at
like
all.
Like what? I'm so excited. Like,
what? Okay. Hang on. I mean, we can talk about it. I mean, like, I suppose it's
how
not
about
yet.
Rickon? Like, I feel like Rickon's zombie army is definitely gonna play some kind of part.
The Skagosi cannibals.
Yes.
I think so, but I wonder if it's just, you know, Davos will get there and he'll be like, these people aren't cannibals. This is like a horrible rumor, you know, I feel like George will subvert that somehow, or maybe not. Maybe they're totally like fucking cannibals. you never know.
The one thing that I always sort of wondered about was how much, and again, I'd be keen to know, again, I have not read meta about this kind of stuff, but the alleged lost Targaryen baby, you know, the little brother,
yes,
you know, Rhaegar's younger Aegon. Son,
yeah,
who went on, you know, his little blue-haired trip down the river, you know, and I'm like, that was not even like a blip on the show, but did you think that guy was ever a contender, like...
Well, no, I mean, no, because look, like, not to, so remember when Dany was in the House of the Undying, and there's a lot of setup for this idea that there's going to be a fake Targaryen claimant to the throne. Yeah. And so I think he had to pay that off, and he does really well. And I think that it's really cool to see Tyrion like see through everything that's going on in that boat and be like, you are not, and none of you are who you say you are. Mm-hmm. And to essentially like derail that entire plot line, I thought was really, really interesting because they're going to Dany.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tyrion's like, what, you think like your aunt's just going to be like, oh,
yeah,
great,
sure.
Like, you're still alive. Like, let's get married.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think that the kid thinks he is who he says he is? Do you think he's one of those positions where he's been raised to believe it? Like
Every single person on that boat thinks he is who he says he is. I especially think that, like, yeah, everybody does. I mean, it's like Illyrio and Varys who know the truth, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a lot of speculation that he's a Blackfyre pretender. Uh-huh. So there is some connection between Aegon, his bloodline, and the Blackfyre Rebellion, because sellswords, the Golden Company, who were Bittersteel sellswords. I'm getting really too far into
No. Please.
This is
do.
Great. Keep going.
Please do.
So yeah, I agree with you. But I mean, in the books now, like the speculation is that he's going to go. Well, it's not speculation. Like, so he has now landed in Westeros and is like conquering the Westeros and like has taken Griffin's Roost, right?
Yeah.
And is going to like rendezvous with Arryn Martell, and there's going to be a Dornish Targaryen alliance. And I think he's going to take King's Landing and like he's going to be King Aegon for a hot second.
So yeah, so this that's
there's
definitely
gonna another Dance of Dragons. There's going to be another like Targaryen civil war, interconflict. There has to be, right?
Yeah. So it definitely sounds like that kind of thing. Yeah, there's all of these setups that, you know, are not where we are currently seeing the heroes in the show go. Jaime and Brienne at the mercy of dead Catelyn. You know, like we don't, we don't really know what that might change.
To me, that's the most, like, the omission of Lady Stoneheart is one of the more egregious things.
Yeah, so that's something you would have liked to be.
Yeah, fuck yeah. That would have been so awesome. And also just, like, the fact that Arya isn't really a warg on the show. And there's that great books where she drags her mother's dead body out of a river as Nymeria.
Yeah.
And I just, like, I want those magical elements. I want that. I don't want just like John to be the warg, or sorry, Jeff Bran.
Yeah,
like, I want them all to be wargs, which they all are.
Yeah, I don't think that they even have really, you know, with Bran's sort of magical lessons. You know, we've obviously had the warging into Hodor and that kind of thing, but it definitely felt like that was something that was like meant to be all of them, and that would maybe be the thing that gave them the edge in some way. So it's just interesting the choices they've made. I think for me, the more disappointing omissions out of any book to screen adaptation are missing the feelings that internal monologue stuff gives you, you know, like, mm-hmm. I think Dani in the House of, like, in The Undying, when she's kind of seeing the hints that we sort of know later to be about, you know, Rhaegar and Lyanna and all of the internal processing of, like, what people learn and don't say, I don't feel like the show adapts that well, or any show. I feel like that's the biggest loss when you adapt something is these internal, you can sit there with a camera on someone's face, but you're not necessarily getting
totally
the evocative feeling of what you're reading them in their mind. So
yeah, and I also think that it's just like hard as fuck to do that in a show.
Yeah,
because when you're reading the book, he's obfuscating a lot of it. Mm-hmm. A lot of what her visions are in like beautiful prose, mm-hmm. you know? And so you're not like, oh, this is obviously Jon Snow.
Yeah. We see a flower and it's still on the screen and it still wouldn't really be painted in the way that the words teach you something, you know?
Exactly. Like it's all symbolism and subtext and all of these lovely things. But if you put that on screen, it's sort of like, it's Jon. John's Lyanna's son. It's really hard to adapt that stuff, I think.
Yeah. Before we get into our hypes and gripes, I saw an interesting, you know, question on Twitter the other day about what people think was done well, like the things that really did feel like the best moments of the books that created the same feeling. Obviously, it's surpassed it in some way. I really loved the reveal of, like, the final, like, reveal of the Tower of Joy and the truth about John. Mm-hmm. I really loved how they did that. I thought that was incredibly well executed, even though it hadn't been in the books, and it was just what I wanted it to be.
I totally agree, but I'm also like, there's always one thing that they don't give us, that they could easily give us, but they don't, like Arthur Dayne's sword.
Yeah.
Just give us a fucking sword. Like, I don't need, him to, like, have two awesome swords that he's, like, spinning around. He's like, look at my two swords. Like, just give me a sword.
Yeah.
That's formed as a meteor and is and glows and is awesome. Like, why not? Let's just do it.
So have there been any moments for either of you that have made you have that feeling of kind of like really real happiness or chills or like uncontrollable weeping that you're not, you know, really too rational to have, but are having anyway, that like, this is exactly how I wanted it to be, or this is exactly what I wanted for the character on screen?
For me, the one moment that I always think of is Jon and Sansa reuniting, because in the books I had always wanted, I really wanted them to be the first, he's not a Stark, but the first Stark to reunite again, because I just felt like they were such, even though they're painted as polar opposites, they really are the two that I feel like are the most alike in terms of morality. Mm-hmm. And because they weren't very close, I thought it would be interesting for them. And that was just really emotional, because we spent like 5 seasons with no Starks on the same screen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then, like, when they see each other, it's such a, like, the looks on their faces, mm-hmm. it gets me every time.
Yeah, I still feel very strongly about that in terms of, yeah, basically what they've been through on their journey apart, like that they were very different level of kind of naivety to the good and evil of the world when they left Winterfell. And so I think it would be a very different reunion if it had been Jon and Arya first, you know, because they were already close or something like that. So I think that is really, really beautiful. I love most of the stuff with Jaime and Brienne, especially the Harrenhal stuff. I think that's one of the best executed on the show. There are obviously huge issues that we've had with Jaime. Arianna, you remember walking around Santa Monica Pier on my birthday with both of us just trailing behind the group screaming about the rapist episode.
Yeah, but so unnecessary.
It's just, that's a whole
I'm cited in Jaime Lannister's Wikipedia entry.
Are you? Because of that article. Oh my god, that's amazing. I'm obsessed with that. That's really hilarious, but it's horrible. But most of the Jaime and Brienne stuff I felt like was just, I don't know if it's the actors or if whoever was writing that had a soft spot for that relationship, but I feel like that was just exactly how I wanted it from the books. Yeah, what about you, Meredith? What has been your most satisfying moment to see play out?
I think I'm going to have to say probably the Battle of Blackwater. Mm-hmm. it's such a huge undertaking.
And it's
such
a pivotal. Cool.
It's cool, but it's also a pivotal character moment for so many of our leads and people that I love. Like, you know, for Sansa, for the Hound, for Cersei, for Tyrion, for, you know, so many people. And I love seeing Cersei and Sansa, and Cersei's getting progressively drunker. And Sansa's like, how am I going to get out of this? And it was great.
It's quite a feat. Some of the, you know, actual visual feats that they've pulled off are pretty uncomparable to, you know, to anything else that we have on television. And Game of Thrones ending this year, it's at a period where we have a lot of endings, like not just this show. We have the end of, like, you know, we're about to have the end of the Marvel Universe as we know it. Like, it will carry on, but it's certainly a huge ending point. We have this final Star Wars trilogy, and it just feels like that there's a lot of things happening in the next 12 months that are kind of an end to genre as we know it, like, or at least the more public, you know, people who are really deep in fandom always have their obsessions and things to find, and they also obviously never die. We've also obviously got this announcement about Supernatural as well, which I'm not going to talk about in detail, but it is such a huge weight to think about that these, and that's not as publicly that's not, you know, every person on the street, you know, knows about that, but I'd say out of every other sort of smaller genre show, that it is probably, because of its enduring length, one of the most prominent to, you know, someone on the street would probably know what it was, as opposed to, like, Black Sails or something, you know. So given this kind of era of Game of Thrones, Supernatural is almost comparable in terms of the amount of, I guess, world building you're handling.
Oh yeah,
that's certainly a very unique, you know, unique achievement to think about into, you know, handling something with not so many players, but, you know, so much history. What's next for the genre audience? Like, what do you think, having these big, huge epics capture the world in the sort of, you know, in the 21st century? Do you think that we're going to see this level of this scope of storytelling grow, or do you think it's going to kind of go to, you know, more variety of smaller properties or something like that? That's a bit of a huge philosophical question, but I feel like we've taught the world, maybe people who weren't always readers, maybe people who weren't always invested in slow payoff, long form storytelling, Marvel becoming a serialized, like, you know, it's just basically a season of television in movie form. What's next for this long form genre storytelling? Do you think it's repeatable, or, you know, can you imagine something like Game of Thrones happening again for the wider public?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what's so fun about Game of Thrones is it feels like, I mean, for people who were not book readers initially, it feels like it kind of came out of nowhere, right? Like we've always lived under the specter of how fantastic Star Wars is.
Marvel. Lord,
I mean, my whole life I've lived under, like, you know,
Lord of the Rings. Like, yeah.
And so I think one thing that Thrones proves and A Song of Ice and Fire proves is that you don't know where it's going to come from, and that's really exciting.
That's very true. There could be some epic. One of my favorite books and, you know, series, they're a lot less sophisticated than A Song of Ice and Fire, and, you know, teen fantasy, the Tamora Pierce's Tortall universe, the Lady Knight stories. Yeah. You know, that's never been optioned for television, but, you know, and that's something that's had, like, a quiet, passionate readership for, you know, since the 80s. And it could be that someone decides to option that right and everyone becomes obsessed with it. It could be that Sandman gets
optioned. Exactly, Sandman.
You know, like, I something
think
like
Sandman
that.
Sandman is a good idea, is a good guess.
Yeah, that kind of, like, thing where we're capturing, like, a story that, you know, maybe a few people knew about in its original source, but we're bringing it to other people.
Yeah, I mean, it becomes a zeitgeist defining thing, which is very weird and very cool, because it is such, like, I mean, Thrones, it's such a weird book series, but in the best possible way.
Yeah, it's just not something I ever would have expected to be as popular as it is with people who aren't used to, you know, long form storytelling or books, because it does. It covers so many like random family trees that you have to, you know, keep track of. And like, you know, I know people who watch the show and are like, oh, I've forgotten what that character's name was, but the one did this. And I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm just going to, I mean, it's good. It's good that you're watching. But
yeah, I get it.
You know, you're a TV writer. Ariana will be a TV writer. Would either of you want to work on a kind of show that is, like, fulfilling a legacy like Game of Thrones, like, to be adapting something with that kind of very heavy, detailed source material?
Yes. Because to be honest, I feel like women do it better. So
really? Well, that would be cool. What, to like, honor that kind of history and know what details matter, or?
Well, I think there's just, like, a little bit less, like, casual raping.
I mean, so. Yes, there is. There's certainly that to consider. But, yes. So we're going to say goodbye to Game of Thrones, I suppose, in the best possible fashion by talking about all the things we hate about it. But no, also yeah. we're going to talk about the things we love about it. So it's really, you know, such a broad show. For our hypes and gripes portion, we're going to talk about, you know, the things we love and hate about the books or the show or what the show has done to the books. Yeah, there's probably a million and one we could do, but we're each gonna focus on something. So, Ariana, would you like to take it away with your first gripe?
Sure. So for the longest time, until really Feast for Crows, when the Martells were introduced, Jon Snow was my favorite character, and he's still in my top two. And I loved how intuitive he was and how smart and like wise for his age, even though he's 14. And he really got me. He got me from like the first chapter. Yes, first chapter, not including prologue, when Theon kicks that head. And he's just like, ass. And I was like, yes, thank you. And I love that he's all of his siblings' favorite sibling. And he was smart, and Tyrion was like, yeah, this is a smart guy. He's a good guy. And I just don't understand why in the show, like, everyone thinks Jon Snow is dumb. Like, now the greater population is like, Jon Snow's dumb. Stupid Jon Snow. And it just really frustrates me that his intelligence hasn't been brought across in the same way. So it's just frustrating. And not, yeah.
Oh, why do you think that happened?
I think part of me feels like I think there's some things that the show does really well in terms. I want to give them credit where credit's due. And I think genuinely the Lannisters of the show are better than the Lannisters in the book. I think they're more complex and interesting. And I feel like a lot of that has to do with what the actors bring to it. But I feel like the showrunners also have given them really great monologues, and they're playing to their strength. But part of me feels like maybe they just don't get the same things out of Jon Snow that I do. And like, I feel like they really want to play up like his moody side.
And to he's me, not that moody.
No, to me, that was never like, I didn't feel like he was moody. I felt like he was just a regular teenager who was in a, you know, in a really cold place. And he kind of gets over that pretty quickly. And I just wish that they would play it more of the fact that, like, because he relates so much to the underdog, he really, he reminds me a lot of Benny from The Sandlot in terms of, like, helping the smaller children and just being, like, a wise leader. And
yeah, I feel like there are some things about him that could have been better. I like him some of the time. I mean, obviously, first of all, the show aged everyone up, which I think was a good choice for some reasons. But in other ways, some of the things that were kind of interesting about the Starks was the kind of things they were able to achieve or the way their mindsets changed, like, as effectively children. Like, you know, Rob as the King in the North at 15 is very different to Rob as King in the North at 20, I think. That's a huge, you know, there's sort of a nobility in this childish boy king that's maybe a bit different to how it would come across with an adult. But John, I don't know. There's a warmth to him in the books that I don't necessarily think is there in the show.
It's tricky because I think he's a fairly passive protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's got like a passive heroism to him. Mm-hmm. You know, like he's told to do something and he does it. It's very, and not until kind of like later in the books, I think. And except for in very small ways, mm-hmm. is he really driving a lot of action?
Mm.
And they mostly excised those beats. You know what I mean? Like they cut those. And I get it because, like, you know, the interpersonal drama of like what's happening at Castle Black is like maybe not going to hold focus when you've got like so many characters to service.
Yeah. But
I mean, you know, what's so great about John's arc is like he is an underdog, but then he goes to Castle Black and he's not.
Yeah.
And he's got like all this great training and he's a rich kid. Mm-hmm. And he's treating everyone kind of like shit. And
yeah.
it takes to your being like, look in the mirror, you know, like, is this really who you want to be? And
yeah,
was just like that. And the show kind of like fainted at that storyline, but like kind of like didn't land it.
Yeah.
And then it was so long ago. And then you have, you know, Corrin Half Hand being like, kill me. Like, you know, it's, he's kind of thrust. John is, especially early on in his arc, he's thrust into these situations where he has to prove himself. And I think that's a lot more interesting when you're inside his head in a point of view chapter than it is when you're just dramatizing it.
I think you're totally right. I feel like the proactive, supposedly, choices that he's making are very internal ones, like mm-hmm. where it's a small choice between this and that that you might not necessarily see someone making. But when you're reading it, you can see his process.
Yeah.
He's doing this.
I think that every character suffers from that a bit in the show, in that, you know, when we are going with someone from their point of view, it's a very different relationship, a very different understanding, very different sympathy to observing it. Even if we know what they're meant to be going for, what they're meant to be going through, it's a very different process to watch someone objectively do something and to be with them in their mind as we are seeing their decisions. And I think that some of the characters have really suffered from that. John is kind of, I don't know where he sits on that scale of suffering or not suffering. It's certainly an issue for any kind of thing. And I think that's one of the biggest losses of the show. Are there any other characters you think that have really suffered in that way from the point of view for either of you? Which is the worst to you? I think Meredith is going to say Stannis.
Look, the one true king. No, but Stannis doesn't have any point of view chapters.
I thought there was one book where he did. I honestly cannot remember. No. So yeah. Okay.
Davos Seaworth is the eyes on
champion.
Stannis.
Yeah.
And then Melisandre obviously gets point of view chapters down the road. But like they did that character so dirty, in my opinion.
So far in the books, no king has had a point of view, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Rob doesn't, Robert doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Stannis doesn't.
No, and Renly doesn't.
Mm.
And
just Iron John. Horn.
Yeah.
Yeah, but John's not a king yet in the books.
Well,
and I don't. And I, you know what? Like unpopular opinion. I don't know that I think he will ever be.
Well, I think that there's like kind of a pro in a way to, you know, a king not being someone who is like personally ambitious, and a king who is, you know, someone who is sort of like, you know, not a conqueror. But John, I don't know how this story is going to end for him or for anyone.
Yeah, like, is there going to be an Iron Throne at the end of this? I don't know. Not convinced. Also, John's a fire white. Like, we forget that because the show, like, lets us forget that. But, like, Rohalor brought him back.
Well, like, yes, that's what I'm going to say. Do you think that he is the prince that was promised?
I think Danny is the prince that was promised.
Okay. Cool. I know there's a lot of theories there, so.
I mean, they could both be. It's, you know, like many, many ways. There are lots of legends.
Yeah.
Exactly. So.
Yeah, of course. At the end of the day, do you think that legend matters?
I hope so. I think it has to, right? I mean, there's just a lot of time spent on it.
It's true. Like, we're wasting everyone's time if it's not.
I'm all for, like, a good helping of bathos, but, like, that's ridiculous.
Well, you know, we'll have to see, you know, whether that equals the true ruler of Westeros, or if, you know, it's going to be like, you know, John did win an election, so perhaps we'll introduce democracy to Westeros.
He won an election, but then he was assassinated.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't go that well.
He was Julius Caesar'd.
Yeah. So, okay, yeah, point of view characters obviously all lose a bit of your faith, or not your faith, but, like, you really getting their choices and having, you know, rooting for them in a particular situation. Is there a point of view character, Meredith, for you that you feel like really lost out for that?
John is pretty much the one. John is really the one. I mean, because he is so eternal, and he is such a great character on the page. And I think a combination of, you know, how he was written and how he was acted, it's a bummer. I mean, they just don't let him ever be funny or have fun.
Yeah.
Also, is a big part of it.
And what's a shame is, I feel like, thank you for saying it, I feel like he's not the strongest actor, but I do think that he is the strongest when he gets to be a little bit lighter, like when he gets to tell a joke.
He's great on, like, you know, like Saturday Night Live and, like, talk shows and shit. Like,
yeah, I can't hold this. And it's interesting because Kit Harington's a theater actor as well, and I don't know if that makes a difference. Like, I know people adapting from stage to screen and back is like, they, you know, there's a different way of using the face that I know is sort of made people suffer in like, you know, one way or the other. But I don't know exactly
I also think a combination of, this is maybe a small thing, but, like, the fact that they shoot it, where do they shoot it, in Iceland?
Everywhere.
So, like, it's fucking cold as shit. Like, yes.
He's suffering.
They're, like, kind of squint. They're always, like, kind of squinting through their furs.
Yeah,
he
doesn't have a lot of time to open his eyes and smile. Yeah. Again, maybe unpopular opinion, I think with that suffering point of view character, I think Danny for me is the big one.
Oh, you're right.
I get Danny in the books, and I think that being with her in her mind while she makes the choices that she makes, it's a very different situation to watching her on the screen. I think it's, and, you know, maybe that's just, you know, maybe what we see on screen is how she looks to her subject, but it's not the same as really getting her. And I don't really like her on the show, I think that's probably a big issue for her there.
I think there are a couple of characters who have their plot lines and dance, and their character dance, like, were clearly things that, like, the showrunners did not have time to service or, like, didn't want to deal with.
Yeah.
And the problem is, in absence of those things, like, those characters kind of don't make a ton of sense.
Mm.
They're kind of just, like, floundering. And I think Danny is one of them. I think Tyrion's another one. And that, kind of, like, without Danny going through what she goes through in dance, I mean, it's pretty clear to me, at least, and maybe I could be totally wrong, but that she's being set up for, like, a pretty big anti-hero turn. Like, she's going to go pretty dark, I think.
Yeah.
And I don't think they wanted to do that. They didn't want to see her, like, you know, murder for Aegon Targaryen and, like, accidentally half of King's Landing. they were like, just let Cersei do that.
I mean, we have had, like, touches in the show of her, making these choices that are clearly tyrannical, you know, like, and they just don't seem to want to lean into it. And this is, I'll segue into my gripe, because my gripe is John and Danny as a pair, like, as a ship. That entire season of that slow burn
as a ship on a ship,
it was just painful, because it ties
what
into what
slow
Ariane's
burn
saying.
Natalie. There was no match anywhere.
The wet log, you know, like, that is John and Danny. And then I know that,
poor, like, Davos Seaworth, like, poor, like, Liam Cunningham being given dialogue, like, I see how the way you look at each other, and you're like, what?
they didn't. And this is what's so interesting to me, because I think it ties to Ariana's point about John being dumbed down, or, you know, whatever it is, you know, to summarize that sort of a bit briefly. What we see with Danny during that season. And what we see when John meets her and how he reacts to her and how he watches her, to me, did not add up to, oh, my God, she's so great and I'm falling in love with her. To me, it added up to, like, I was watching Kit Harington watch Emilia Clarke and think, oh, he's going to realize that she's corrupt.
Yeah, like, she's crazy.
I thought that he was watching her with this, you know, and I know that John and Danny from pre-show has always been a, like, a ship that people kind of fantasized about in the books, that, like, these, you know, they are the ice and fire, you know, of the story, and that people thought that was either going to be like a challenge between the two of them, or it was going to be a romance, or it was going to be like an allegiance, that they were two of the three heads of the dragon, you know, that kind of thing. So we knew that this was coming, but when they did this season, it was like boringly antagonistic to watch them together.
And then, because it's like such a big, like, because the, it's such a silly plan that they come up with, like, because the threat of the White Walkers is so massive at that point, like, Hardhomes happened in the last season. You're just like, this is a huge fucking problem.
Yeah.
And unlike in the books, when, like, you know, good Queen Alysanne discovered that she couldn't fly her dragons over the wall, like, at any point, Daenerys Targaryen could have hopped on fucking Drogon and, like, I don't know, scouted the White Walker situation.
Yeah, like...
But instead, it's like the cockamamie plan of, like, we're going to capture a white and, like, bring that white back down to King's Landing. Like,
I do love the council of all the different factors when they all come together. I love the way that everyone looks at each other, like, you know, like Brienne, Cersei and Jaime. I love the kind of dynamic of everyone re-encountering each other. But was it meant to be funny when they showed them the white? Because it came across as, like, so farcical and so stupid. But them as a ship, the way that they just carried on all season, being, like, slightly bitchy to each other, and then, like if we were meant to think that this was, like, a hot chemistry burning, it did not happen.
See, and my contention that is that, like, it would have happened if they had been sniping at each other for reasons we understood.
I suppose,
like,
that's...
Like, if they had each been dug into their position for reasons that we were totally like, yeah, no, that makes sense. That's, like, a great position. Like, and they were loggerheads. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It's just, I don't know, what the hell is going to happen now? Because, you know, that sex scene was one of the worst sex scenes I've ever seen. I'm so sorry to everyone involved. I really like both of the actors as human beings. They're really great. That story that Emilia Clarke published the other day is just mind-blowing. I know, and I just have amazing. The most respect for her as a person. And I think she's got a great face. I think she's a good actress. But, oh, my God, it's just the worst chemistry in the world. And
it didn't help that, like, you're narrating how they're related as it's happening.
Oh my god. So remind me of, at this point, who knows about John, that he is Rhaegar's son?
So Samwell Tarly, Bran, and whoever either of those two people told. And, oh, Howland Reed. But this
okay.
is
the, oh yeah.
This, sorry, this is in the show. In the books, yeah. Just Howland Reed.
Yeah. So at the moment,
and, like, probably Bloodraven, because he knows everything.
Do you think John will find this out soon, and do you think it will affect his relationship with Daenerys?
I think he's going to find it out pretty soon. I feel like as soon as he sees Bran.
Oh, yeah. He's going to be like, spoiler alert, you banged your aunt. Sorry about it. And do you think that she is pregnant?
I hope not.
Because they had that.
You're right. Probably.
Was the end game? Because obviously they did not get to that in the books yet. They have not got to John and Danny meeting.
Oh God.
But in Dance, you know, she seems to start menstruating again. Is that So we're kind of in this. We have this sort of grounds to believe that this might be some magical baby of, like, dragonly honor or something. I don't know. And, you know, do you think that either of them have a shot in this alliance as being successful? Do you think this is going to crash and burn? Do you think they'll end up becoming enemies? you know, what will happen when Dany finds out that he's got, like, that John has more of a right to the throne than her, or, you know, questionable on how you would count that, but that he has a claim.
They'll eke some, like, hollow drama out of it for a couple of episodes, and then, like, the White Walkers are going to come and, like, hand everybody's asses to them at Winterfell. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, it sort of feels a little bit like small potatoes compared to what's happening in the greater world. I don't mean that in terms of their characters. I think it means it's going to mean a shitload for Jon, who's always defined himself as a Stark so strongly, and he is a Stark, but he's not Ned Stark's son. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to damage him more than any sort of, like, claim than excitement or, you know, whatever claim he has to the Iron Throne. I don't think he cares about that.
Yeah. So basically, are they doomed to fail as the world's worst ship, or do you think this is actually something we're going to have to support in some way?
Well, I mean, they're going to, like, die. So.
you think both of them will die?
I do.
Okay, interesting. And who do you think will survive the series?
Sansa.
That's who I was going to say. I was like, probably Sansa.
Probably Sansa. maybe Dany. Probably Sansa. Probably Jaime, weirdly. I think I'm getting a lot of, like...
Really?
I'm getting, like, a lot of, like Lord Commander of the Night's Watch vibes from him.
But Jaime... Doesn't Jaime have to kill Cersei before killing himself? Isn't that, like, the prophecy?
Yeah, but I think that's... They're not going to do that in the show. Because he already left her. So how's he going to go back? He's going to, like, go back there and kill her?
To kill her.
But after the White Walkers are dealt with, he's going to go back there and kill her?
Where are they at in the show? Where are the Lannisters at in the show? Because the Lannisters are my favorite. Jaime and Tyrion, and kind of the weirdness between Jaime and Cersei. But, you know, I think that the show has brought Jaime back to Cersei more times than I would have liked. In the books, when he called for help, she called for help in her trial as her champion, you know, he didn't come back. And this time he still wasn't her champion, but... You know, there was a lot more of his mental place of, like, I'm done with her. You know, this is, like, you know, what I thought it was, it's not. And he kind of really, you know, really rejected her. And I don't feel like he's, you know, it took him a longer time to really reject her.
Well, left her. He's going up north.
Yeah.
To deal with the White Walkers.
Yes. But in the books, plot wise, he had left her. Long before that, like, he had left her kind of, like, allegiance, you know, even though he was still on the side of, I guess, like,
yeah,
Tom,
I mean, but he's
army.
He's still, like, fighting. He's still fighting her war for her, like, in the Riverlands.
But he's like, we're not gonna be a gross couple anymore, like, long before that. And so I'm glad that he's left her. I'm glad that he's come to his senses. I would love it if he survived as kind of, like, a lone. Not a hero, but, you know, like a redemption, like a surviving redemption arc. And I think that suggestion as Lord Commander of the Night's Watch would be amazing. So keep your fingers crossed, I suppose.
I hope so. I'm trying to think of who else I am convinced will live through this. Tyrion?
Sam?
Yeah, because somebody
Sam
has to,
probably,
like, write the book.
Tell the story, yeah.
Yeah.
What about Arya?
No, maybe.
No, she's... No. I think she's dead. She's a goner.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. And I feel like the show might not kill her, but I think the books are definitely going to kill her.
And then what about people like, I guess, Varys? I'm weirdly attached.
Super dead.
Yeah.
So dead. Varys and Melisandre had that great conversation about how they're both going to die in this weird foreign country, like, season.
That's true. Tyrion, I don't know. Tyrion, I would like to be... What I originally wanted was for I kind of wanted the Tyrion... Before I realized how terrible Jon and Dany were going to be. Like, I was kind of... I never loved it, but I was kind of like, I guess, like... But then when the show did it, I was like, this is the worst thing I've ever seen in my life. no offense, show. It was just so horrible. But I kind of thought that maybe they would, like, stay as... Like, that those two and another, like, who, you know, third head of the dragon might have, like, a council of kings, like, to be, like, a group of kind of, like, like a
triumvirate.
Yeah, like a rulership by council, and you know, maybe with, I don't know, like, I know there were rumors about Tyrion Targaryen, which I don't necessarily believe, but I think he'd be good at ruling kingdom. So, but I don't think Jon will live, though, for sure. So
yeah, I tend to agree.
And I don't know what he'd do with himself in a position of power like that. I think he would feel very uncomfortable.
And the problem is, I don't think Dany is in position to run anything anymore either.
No.
Like, I don't think they've made any sort of like case for her as a great ruler.
No. I feel like, you know, we've seen her basically conquer lands that aren't hers, and you know, we've got this perspective that it's this like lovely, you know, that she's a savior of the people, but like, I don't think that, you know, and the show has been accused of like doing like a white savior arc, and I'm kind of like, yeah, I think that was the point, you know, like
maybe whatever she does in this fight for the Dawn will make her that leader, you know, it's like the only hope, I guess, I have, if she lives, which I don't know, you guys, I feel like they both might, wouldn't put it past the show.
I guess, you know, the Targaryens, what do you think will come out of the fact that the conquering, like Robert's Rebellion,
mm-hmm.
what do you think would happen to Westeros if that comes out that was a fallacy? You know, that what Robert was fighting for, that the reason he deposed the Targaryens, I mean, obviously Aerys was a nutcase, but the fact that he fought Rhaegar and, you know, who would have been a great king.
No, he wouldn't.
I like sad boys, so just, you know.
He plays the harp.
No, he does play the harp. He's so sad.
It's very nice.
There are a lot of political reasons why Aerys had to go that have nothing to do with Lyanna and nothing to do with Rhaegar. And everything to do with, like, the feudal social contract between kings and their vassals and their lords paramount, basically. Like, you know, if you're king and you can summon your lords paramount and then kill them all, like, no lord paramount, like, your lords paramount, they're all going to rebel. They're the ones that have the standing armies.
No, I totally agree about that. But there's this moment in the books where Rhaegar tries to talk to Ned or Robert about it, to be like, yeah, Dad's got to go. Like, Rhaegar was aware of that as well. So
no, he fucked off. Like, he there was a moment
dad.
Yeah, like, you're talking about Harrenhal, right? Like, how there was a moment during that tourney, and he said, like, so Rhaegar put that tourney together to maybe get, like, the Lords Paramount to help, to back him and depose his father. But his father, like, figured out that conversation was probably going to happen. And so he went to that tourney.
Oh, fair enough. Fair enough, fair enough.
It dashed Rhaegar's plans, and Rhaegar kind of, like, didn't have a backup plan. So his backup plan was, like, run away with Lyanna and, like, have another kid to fulfill a prophecy.
Fair enough. I got the impression that Rhaegar was kind of aware that things were getting really bad and that they needed to figure out something. But, you know, we also haven't seen a lot of Rhaegar, I suppose, like, you know, we have seen none of his own real perspective. He's kind of a legendary figure, and the show hasn't really delved into a lot of, like, direct conversations with him either. But either way, if it comes out that, you know, that Baratheon rebellion was, I guess, like, if the truth about, like, Jon comes out, do you think that would change people's opinions on, like, the Baratheon rebellion, like, deposing the Targaryens, like, full stop?
At this point, I feel like when people find out about Jon, are you saying people would support him more? I feel like people would be much angrier in the show universe, because here they are. They made him their king, assuming that he's Ned Stark's son. And then he basically sold the North to this hot blonde girl who came down. Yeah.
And now in that narrative, like, it all makes sense because he's a secret Targaryen. Like,
I agree. I found when Dany returned to Westeros, you know, like, country that she'd never really remembered, I found it, like, very much like, you really expect people to support you. Like, I found it very surprising, the amount of confidence that she had that people would, like, want to accept her as their ruler. So there is that, I suppose. Anyway,
and if you look at, like, the Targaryen dynasty in general, like, it was forged with dragons. And I think with dragons it will end. Like, yeah, without their dragons, after the dance, and the eventual extinction of dragons, like, the Targaryens have had a really tough time.
Yeah.
Actually maintaining control on Westeros. And so it feels like Robert's rebellion was the natural end point of that.
Yeah.
Like, it was all going to culminate with that eventually. If not that rebellion, like, some other would have taken them down. And so I think there's a nice story symmetry to, like, Aegon the Conqueror and his sisters taking Westeros this way, and then the Westeros he forged kind of falling back into these smaller city states with Dany dying and her dragons dying, which
I
unfortunately
think that's
very well too.
Yeah, I think that's a really fair point in terms of, like, the Targaryens having power. You know, they had power for this reason. They had this weapon of mass destruction, so they had to be in charge. And once that weapon's gone, who, you know, what do they have to actually be in charge with? Like, what proves that is actually a rational leadership? And I guess Robert's rebellion, I mean, outside of his horrible relationship with his wife, you know, do you think that the Baratheon line would have been, like, a good, normal, you know, for the people kingship?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, the Baratheons are our Targaryen cadet house. Like, they're a bastard Targaryen house.
Yeah.
Like, so maybe Renly's not a great, was never going to be a great king. Stannis was, but, like, people wouldn't have wanted him to be. Mm-hmm. And so I think the arguments that the books kind of keep making is that, like, it's very, very hard to rule people that you don't understand.
In that case, and we'll go into your gripe now, you mentioned breaking it back up into the Seven Kingdoms. Do you think that's a likely end where we actually have, like, a rulership of these different kingdoms as the country once was, with you know, smaller government of smaller areas that are of that people, you know?
I tend to think so.
And, you know, obviously the North, Riverlands, Dorne, and, you know, the Iron Islands. And you apparently seem to have some particular...
And the Reach, yeah.
And with some particular beef with the Iron Islands.
It's taken me, like, being in this fandom to appreciate all of the Greyjoys and all of their bullshit. Mm-hmm. and kind of, you know, getting granular on and hearing other people's takes on Euron and Victarion and Yara Asha and Theon. But my God, was that mishandled in the show?
Yeah, I think so. In the show, I found very interesting how much sympathy I ended up having for Theon. I really, you know, his arc is horrible and evocative, and, you know, shout out to Ewan Rian, our Welsh friend, for playing such a horrific...
such a piece of shit.
such a horrific character that it made Theon, like, really sympathetic.
Yes.
But tell me about how you think the Ironborn were hard done by.
Well, I tend to just think that if you're not going to... Like, why is Euron in this story?
Yeah.
Like, if you're not going to have, like, Victarion, Euron, and all of, like, the weird eldritch evil shit that they're doing, and the dragon binder stuff, like, what? Just don't do it.
Yeah.
Get him out of there.
We did spend a weird amount of time on that whole, like, quest for kingship in the Iron Islands and all of their, you know, rituals, and it has not really had a payoff. You know, we've got obviously the, you know, one guy being, you know, Cersei's love slave or whatever it is. And I honestly can't remember where the show left that off at this point. Is there still an alliance there or not?
I think so.
Or... Isn't she riding north on the Greyjoy ships?
Possibly.
Yeah.
I thought that's where it left, because she was like, oh, while they're all fighting the White Walkers, we're going to take them over. And that's when Jaime was like, this is a stupid plan. I'm leaving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your priorities are on backwards and the tag is showing, you know. But it's interesting that they would, you know, sell the Iron Islands to the south when they'd been so passionately independent, I guess. Do you think that there's a place for Theon to have any sort of... hero moment for his people?
I hope so. I don't know. Like, that's the problem with Stan. Like, there's so many up and backs to that character, as depicted on the show. I mean, just jumping overboard, you know, when he did. And
he really what he's doing at any given moment.
No, but I mean, I loved the beat between him and John Dragonstone. Like, that was awesome. So, yeah. You know, I don't know if redemption is possible for Than. Probably, like, I hope so. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I just think they've done a very good job at making him incredibly sympathetic. I really loved his escape with Sansa. I really loved, like, a lot of aspects of him. But I also really enjoy that, you know, that aspect that when he goes home to the Iron Islands as their prince, that they're like, you are not one of us anymore because you were fostered at Winterfell and all of that kind of stuff. Do we know what happened to Yara Osha? I mean, she was tortured and raped and possibly dead. But is he going back to save her now? Is that, like, that kind of felt like the end of the last season. He's like, oh, shit, I've got to do this. I was a silly boy and now I've got to be a good boy. Like, so perhaps we'll get something between those siblings again. But I don't know.
I mean, putting aside Theon, who really was dead to me from chapter one, I can't stand Theon.
His whole rule of Winterfell and pretending to burn the kids, like, it's not really
pretending to burn them. He killed actual kids. Those are real dead kids.
Yes.
Pretty but hard to
anyway,
get back from.
It's fine because he's not a real Greyjoy anyway. The Iron Islands don't want him, so it's fine. I personally love the Greyjoys. Asha is in my top three favorites ever. And I just think that they're fascinating. Like, they're so weird. And they have, like, their code of honor makes sense to me, as weird as it is.
Really?
And it makes sense within their culture. But I remember, like, when they did the Kingsmoot, and when Euron walks in with that horn, I was like, this is a game changer. This is definitely going to be very important going on. And in the show, it's not.
It's
like,
not.
It's not at all.
Like,
yeah.
No.
But yeah, it is really frustrating to watch them kind of just be relegated as, like, Cersei's, like, side bitches who kind of do the dirty work for her instead of being fully realized characters. But
yeah, I think for me, like, it was just always so hard to get on board with a culture that basically, like, you know what, fuck it, let's just, like, rape and take everything.
But if Asha was their queen, they wouldn't do that anymore because she wants peace.
They know, but then they're going to have to find a new house sigil and new words. They don't sell, man. They don't sell.
Oh, God.
Right there on the flag.
Ew. Okay. We'll move on to positives, I suppose, to the things that we actually do really love about the series or the books or how the books, you know, how the series has handled the books. Speaking of, we're talking about one house, I guess. We're talking about one country, the Iron Islands. Arianna, you put your hype as Dawn, but I saw originally that you also had your gripe as Dawn. So take us to that southern land.
That's because Dorne is by far my favorite thing in the entire books. And also the worst thing I think they've ever done on the show. When I was like, it's fine. This show, I don't really care what happens anymore. Because to me, it's not canon anymore because they screwed up Dorne. I don't know. I don't know what to say. Like,
tell
in terms of gripes,
like,
I've written several essays on why it's so problematic and they, in so many ways, what they've done on the show. But in terms of things I love, I just love that Dorne is so well adjusted. Like, I love that the Martells are, like, a nice family that love each other and, like, bicker, but, like, in a normal way. They don't have, like, their weird hangups are just normal, weird family hangups. And the kids seem like they can just act like real kids. And, like, obviously they have primogeniture, so it doesn't matter if you're born a boy or a girl.
Yeah.
I feel like what Doran did to Quentin is pretty egregious, though.
I mean, did they know that what he was going to happen? Like, you have to go and get your wife, like, you know, that you're meant to be with, like, they couldn't have known what was going to happen.
No, but she does. Danny doesn't know about this marriage pact.
Yeah, they could have sent a letter.
and more importantly, like, he could have told Arianne, like, a little bit sooner before things got a little bit out of hand. And I think, like, we're going to see that house really, what's that saying? Like, you know, revenge is like taking poison and hoping somebody else will die.
Mm-hmm.
Like, or vengeance or something. I mean, and that's, to me, like, unfortunately, the House Martell is this very, very, like, long simmering revenge plan that they've staked so much on that is just going to go so badly.
Yeah. Like, they, you know, want... Yeah, I agree with your point. I also agree with Arianna that, you know, when they're not plotting their revenge or, like, you know, how they were meant to have these alliances that never fell through or whatever, that when they're not doing that, they are very lovely and... You know, it was quite sad. You know, all of them seem to die. Which character is your number one of the series?
Oh, it's Arianne Martell. She's my favorite.
And she hasn't really had a role in the show.
No, she got cut out.
Yeah.
She got usurped by her brother, as she always said would happen.
Yeah, interesting.
But not the same brother.
No.
She's getting it from both sides, unfortunately.
Oh my god, what a waste. That's stupid. Anyway.
She's such a waste. She's such a great character.
Do you think there's any hope for Dawn in the future?
I do, in the books.
Mm-hmm.
At least for a little while. I feel like their plans make sense. Of course, everything that makes sense gets ruined. But I like that at least they're, like, thinking things out. And I like that they go slowly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so scared for her. She's hitched her wagon to young Griff. And I think he is very, very doomed.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, that they, you know, that they have this claim, you know, that this child is, you know, I guess half Dawnish, you know, and that, you know, that they were meant to be ascending the throne. Or, you know, bringing their houses together as the rulers of Westeros. So, again, like, eliminating that character of fake Aegon is a really interesting, I feel like, I just keep feeling like that's a big trajectory for how the show is going to differ from the books. I could be very wrong. Obviously, we have that whole, like, revenge plot for the mountain versus the viper, and we have, you know, like, the Ilya having been killed and raped and her babies killed, these half Dornish babies. We get that revenge plot very, very deeply in the show, but we don't get any of this, like, quiet hope for, I guess, Dawn having a stake in the future leader. And so I'm just wondering if that's going to come into play at all in the show and how that might differ from the books. And if it doesn't come into play on the show, is that proof that it doesn't matter in the books or not?
One of the, I don't know, it's so frustrating. One of the most powerful moments in the books for me was when Elia is talking to, like, the Sand Snakes, and she's basically saying, like, can we all just stop with the revenge? Can we just, like, cool it? Because she is actually the only person who, like, actually saw Oberyn die. Like, she saw his brain get smashed, and she's like, this is enough. We don't need to do this anymore. Can we all just go play in the fountains?
Yeah.
And I just thought that was such a, like, powerful message for somebody to send.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the person who should be the most angry is angry, but is like, for the greater good, I'm going to stop, and you all should too. And in the show, obviously,
that does not happen.
No.
No, yeah. She's like the number one revenge harpy.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally. It's an interesting, like, and do you feel like the show has, like, bastardized your beloved Dornish part then, Arianna? Yeah.
Yes, definitely. And not just for her, but even the Sand Snakes, I feel like, get such colorful personalities on the page, even when they're there for, like, you know, a couple sentences.
Yeah.
And they get they're basically, like, they're just seducing and killing people on the show.
And I mean,
you can't tell them apart. You can't tell a single one apart.
Yeah. And it's interesting because in the books, I mean, Marcella's not dead yet in the books.
No,
is she?
She's not dead.
No.
And so
mutilated, yeah, but not dead. Yeah.
And so is there any real proof that the Dornish would actually poison her and kill her? Like, didn't they more want to put her in as a claimant to the throne?
Because like, they're a civilized society. They were like, we're never going to hurt a child. And what I really love about Arianne's storyline is that she is, like, dumb. She's a dumb young person. And in her brain, she was like, oh, I'm going to take this little girl and we're going to go where girl power take over the kingdom. And I'm kind of manipulating her, but it's going to be good for her in the end. And then it totally backfires. And I just feel like she grew up a lot because she had to when she almost got this little girl killed.
Yeah. And she feels really guilty about it. So the fact that they then kill Myrcella is a bit, again, I'm like, all of these changes that are like, kind of like, I don't know, like maybe changes to the ethics of a family or something like that. You know, Meredith would know this much better than me, but like, are they kind of things that like the show has freedom to do without sign off from George? Like, or would he be like, no, you're corrupting the idea of the Dornish, or like, oh, I don't care either way. It doesn't matter.
I think like, does he have a totally stepped back. I think he disengaged.
Yeah. It's just interesting because if I wrote something like, you know, Arianne Martell and, you know, the idea of the Dornish honor, and then the show was like, did something that just proved like that the ethics of this thing that I had like created these values for was being like, not even the plot, but like the morality of it, I would probably feel really stressed out by that. But I have no idea what his level of engagement is. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think he's can't be happy with how the Dornish were depicted on the show. How could you be?
I mean, I don't think that if I was a writer, I don't think I would ever be comfortable with adaptations in this way. I like products to exist within, not, you know, like I like properties to exist. I love some adaptations, but I think properties existing in their first format is always like the safer way. Because like Meredith, for example, like just to like invoke Supernatural for a second, you're already dealing with like a show bible of like 15 years of like lore. But imagine if it was like 15 years of lore plus like possibly disputing stuff from the books. Like, would that be harder or easier because you'd have the source material?
I mean, I think, first of all, it's a gift to have all of the great stories that have been told in the supernatural world to draw from. Yeah. It's awesome. And it's a well that never, ever runs dry because of the beautiful storytelling work that was done before I was lucky enough to join the show. But I think when you look at this show, when you look at Game of Thrones, I think there's a consensus that the storytelling was a lot stronger when they had the books as templates
to base on.
Right. Yeah. And so I think I err on that too. I think if you've got great source material, then it's just, nothing. Yeah. That's a gift. Use it.
Yeah.
But I think that they didn't have the room or the bandwidth or didn't understand Dorne or something. There was some disconnect and they probably shouldn't have done it. Shouldn't have tackled it.
It's just such an interesting case because, you know, Arianna and I both recently started another show which you like, which is The Magicians, which has veered dramatically from the books, and most people find that, like, positive. Like, most people find the way that they've kind of mishmashed parts of the books into, like, a new story inspired by it is a positive. I think here we had an issue where maybe it started very, very tight and then it ran out of road to keep being very tight.
Yeah, and I think that, like, unfortunately, probably for the Dornish plot in the books, probably the Martells don't end up in a very great place. Mm. And so the show felt like it had carte blanche to wrap it up the way it wrapped it up.
Yes, they know that it's, I really appreciate the books spending time. I mean, I know you and I've recently talked about, I think when I was in LA, you were talking about, you know, the story of Quentin Martell and how it's like told as this hero's journey, which totally like blows up in his face. And I think that that's something that I really like about the books, that they will spend time on like building up a story that is going nowhere, and as like a lesson or as like proof that nothing really matters, you know, like as proof that you can, you know, make these, you know, make certain choices and then things happen. So I think that the amount of times that the books will spend time on a story building and building and building to an end that's maybe not like narratively important to the big picture, I love that about the books. But I get why the show is like, we know this isn't going anywhere, so we're not going to do it at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think Quentin Martell exists as a parallel for John and in some ways for Danny. And I really like, I love that storyline. I think it's one of my favorites. It's awesome. Mm-hmm. But certainly like it's all anticlimax. Mm. And I just, you know, I feel like that's probably the Martell's fate across the board. Mm. Mm. I wish it weren't so. I wish Arianne wasn't going to marry young Griff and probably get killed by Danny. But
yeah, not great. Yes. I think, you know, it's just another level of like you can something that you can kind of enjoy, kind of following for the sake of following in the books. But I guess like time and space and money on a TV show is very different. So
yes.
Oh, well, we will go into your hype, Meredith, of Sansa, who is your favorite character. And
she's,
I think,
many
people's favorite character on the show these days. I feel like she had a lot of slack at the beginning, or like that the books, you know, especially at the start, that maybe people did not have as much trust in her or sympathy for her as they do now. I think she's great on the show now. Again, I think Sophie Turner is doing a really good job as well. But tell me about what you see in Sansa and like where it started for you, this passion.
So, well, I have I'm going to wrap my hype in a gripe.
Okay.
I have an issue with the idea that characters who present as typically feminine aren't as interesting or cool as ones that present as typically masculine. And I think that was something that applied to Sansa, especially when she was contrasted with her sister Arya.
Yes.
And especially early on. And I just, you know, I think it's a really interesting way into the political machinations in King's Landing through the eyes of a 13-year-old girl. Mm-hmm. So, or I mean, an 11-year-old girl when she gets there. But, it's because like that character is so overlooked. Mm-hmm. We as a society, I don't think, you know, we tend to sort of like denigrate teenage girls and what teenage girls like and are into. We're very dismissive of it, I think. And so to give the most, arguably the most like interesting perspective for the overarching plot to a 13-year-old girl in King's Landing, I thought was a really awesome choice. And I like seeing someone who is so deeply, deeply misguided about the ways of the world, realizing her mistake and correcting it and becoming a much better, stronger, more interesting person. Mm-hmm. And I like characters that are forced to grow and change that way and who we see fuck up.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's how we measure that growth and that change. I think she's just a really, really fascinating character. And I really like her. I really like Sansa, good old Sansa. Yeah.
Well, I just think that there's a really interesting, you know, awakening there of her kind of being a character that, you know, had this real level of naivety and was like upset about a fantasy being broken. And then like what was built, you know, after she accepted the fantasy was broken, you know, after what she went through with the Arryns, and then after what she went through back in Winterfell. So how do you feel like that the show versus book has treated Sansa?
Well, I mean, I don't love that they gave Sansa Jane Poole's storyline. It's a real bummer. It's a real bummer that Jane Poole had to go through that.
Of course, yes.
And it's a real bummer that Sansa had to go through it too. And you know, for all of the reasons that a lot of like very, very good ink has been spilled on it, people have gone over this. Mm-hmm. But I do think ultimately the book is going to maneuver her into the same place. I think like she will harness the Veil Knights. She will outfox Littlefinger. She'll beat him in his own game. And, you know, we'll get the Veil, we'll muster the Veil Knights for Winterfell.
Yeah.
In some shape or form, probably for the war against the White Walkers, because what's happening right now with Winterfell is that Stannis is fighting Ramsay Bolton. So, and probably going to win that. I mean, I think probably going to win that fight. But, and Jon's like dead.
He is.
You know, for, not for long. I very much look forward to those ghost warg chapters. But, you know, Sansa, I think, is going to come into her own as a political force of nature in Winterfell. And I think somebody who will be very, 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 very good at wielding some political power going forward. I don't think like all of the political power, but I wouldn't be surprised if like the Stark in Winterfell at the end of all of this is Sansa.
Yeah, I think that I could believe that. I've enjoyed the show so far in terms of how they've handled her growing into that sort of Queen in the North role currently since reuniting with Jon. And I think that that is a really, really impressive, powerful change. And I am keen to see how that develops in the book. I feel like Sansa has gotten, you know, to that place of maturity on the show very visibly. I can't remember what her last perspectives in the book is as it stands. But
she's still in the Vale pretending to be someone she's not, and is
building snow castles.
Sort of. Well, she's going to, she's like being set up to marry the heir to Jon, to Jon Arryn's, not Robin, Harry the heir, Jon Arryn's heir, basically, because like Robin's probably gonna die.
Interesting. And Robin is set to come back in the last season of the show, so that could certainly converge back that way.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Obviously, Littlefinger's now dead in the show too, which was fun. That was good. And I suppose we can go into my hype, which is also related to Sansa, which is basically, and this is like very silly, but my hype of the entire Game of Thrones world is like the shipping in terms of like all of the possibilities and how weird some of those possibilities are. And yet it seems like people have a lot less taboo about their weird shipping in Game of Thrones, Song of Ice and Fire world than in other shows. It's just kind of like a free for all. Obviously it's a show that deals deeply on the page with stuff, you know, with stuff like incest, which is, you know, never great. You know, there were different aspects to that in medieval times, but it's still never great in it, in how it's portrayed. But I know Arianna is a big shipper for many things. Her and I have shared many a ship in many a show that we've followed. And I think that there's a lot of interesting romance elements here. So I just want to talk for a minute about anyone's favorite, you know, either legitimate potential endgame romances or ones that are totally fantastical but that you still love anyway. My biggest one has always been Jaime and Brienne, which I think is a pretty like vanilla, like everyone's kind of like, yeah, that's nice and I get why it matters. That was in the book and the show. And I just think that they're lovely, and in a dream world, I would like to see them, you know, have a calm, possibly even asexual marriage, sitting on Tarth, being very quiet. And I just don't think that's in the cards for either of them, but I would like it to be. Arianna, what has your shipping experience with the show been like? So, like, I know that you and I have a couple of faves.
Yeah, most of my... I don't know how I feel anymore. I would say definitely Jaime and Brienne is still the one I hold a torch for. They're precious. I did write a very lengthy article on why Jon and Sansa made the most sense politically. And I was reading it today and I was like, this still makes sense.
Yeah.
But I'm not shipping it anymore because Jon is crazy. And so Sansa deserves better.
I feel like they had a good chemistry. I mean, more than her and Danny.
They had a weird chemistry. That's for sure.
When they reunited, there was a lot of passionate, like, don't touch my sisters, which I wish I could, like, take as a, like, real, like, family bond. But when you compare it to, like, the dead-eyed relationship with Danny, I'm just kind of like, what exactly is
we
going
weren't the only ones, Natalie, because I would have never written that article if I thought I was the only one who
That's
saw
true.
It. But there was so many people who were like, what are these weird, like, looks
vibes.
They're giving each other?
Yeah.
Yes, these are some weird vibes going on, especially, like, preceding the Battle of the Bastards.
Yeah, I agree. It's fine. And then, Meredith, I know you have a couple as well as want to talk about.
No. Yeah, look, like, I don't think, like, any of my ships would ever sail ever. I'm with you on Jamie and Brienne for sure. However those two characters get out of this Lady Stoneheart mess, I can't wait to see. And I can't wait to see them reunited on the show. I think that's going to be awesome. I'm very excited about Sansa and the Hound's reunion.
Yeah.
You would remiss if I didn't say that.
Well, yeah, I know that's one that's been, from the delving I've done in the internet, not just through your fandom, like the conversations we've had, I know that that's like a popular idea. I've seen that around a lot. And I'm interested, like, I kind of wish we'd got the whole plot of the Hound on his, like monastery island, but we did have a little bit of sort of his nice community.
Well, George R. R. Martin, before he wrote these books, wrote on a little show with Ron Perlman called Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I did not know that.
And that speaks for itself, I think, with that relationship.
So it's basically that recreated.
I think it's a feint toward that. It's playing with that trope, the big, you know, scary, unknowable guy and, like, the young, naive, open-hearted woman or young girl. But in the case of Sandra Clegane, like, the Stark girls change his life.
Yeah, it's
for
true.
Sure. I mean, and even if you excise, like, any sort of romantic thing from that, which the reason I think that ship is so interesting is because it's, like, not Sandor's ship. It's not his thing. It's Sansa's thing.
Yeah.
Like, Sansa keeps his cloak and, like, thinks that they kissed and, like, they didn't kiss. Like, we read that. Like, and so she's misremembering it. And I think that's really, really interesting. And I think is very true of a girl who's that age and kind of working through some of her first.
Yeah.
Crushes and feelings and all those things, but for sure they've had an impact on one another.
Yeah, and he'll be back in this season, and, you know, hopefully in the books. I can't remember if he got off the island yet or not, or if he's just sort of a myth that it might be him or not. But that's cool. And there's just you know, different strokes for different folks in this show. There's just so many very weird ships, and I kind of appreciate that when we've written these articles on Hyperbole, that there is people who are like, how can you say that, you're stupid, but it's not like some sort of toxic, you know, ethical condemnation, you know, with all of these variety of ships, which is very different to some other fandoms in terms of I'm actually not pointing fingers, but just in life, like, there's morality politics in fandoms a lot, and I feel like that the fact that Game of Thrones doesn't have too many of those actually makes for a healthier fandom space. But I wouldn't know the depths of those arguments in, like, the real fandom zones.
I think it can get pretty contentious.
Yeah.
You know, there's an argument to be made that it's, like, not the best to ship, like, a 13-year-old with, like, a 22-year-old.
That's
fair. And that's a fair criticism of that ship that I happen to hold. I don't hold the criticism, I hold the ship.
Is he only meant to be 22? I thought he was meant to be like old, like 40s.
That's the show. That's definitely the show. Like,
so he's a young man. Like, young knight. Okay, well, that's cool. There are lots of interesting ones. I'd love Tyrion to find a worthy woman. That would be nice, or a man, whatever. But who knows what the future holds for Tyrion. He's obviously like a landmark character that everyone just kind of loves. We haven't really talked about him much, but he's sort of a universal equalizer of awesomeness. So, but we'll move on very quickly because I have to send Meredith back to her child. And we will have a question of the day from Leah, Leah TA11. And her question of the day for us today was totally stealing this from another podcast, which is called Binge Mode. I'm not sure if that's one of the ones that you know, Meredith. Q&A episode, but I love the question. If you're given choice of any castle in Westeros, where do you live? She says herself she'd probably pick Sunspear in Dawn, with Highgarden coming in at a close second for climate reasons alone, plus all the wine. So, yeah, what would you choose?
That's such a great question. So awesome.
Do you have an answer?
Yeah, Dorne. I mean, beautiful climate. Yeah. Maybe to not copy her, I would maybe say Starfall, which is a lesser Dornish house, the House Dane, and their beautiful castle. So you enjoy that lovely Mediterranean climate, but are not necessarily living under Dorne Martell's roof.
Yeah, fair enough.
So, sure, I'll go with Starfall.
Yeah. What about you, Ariana? Which of the castles and how, or, you know, which house would you like to belong to? Which castle would you like to live in?
Oh, definitely I would go to Dorne. That's where the brown people go. And yeah, to live with the Martells.
Yeah.
And that, in that fountain place.
The fountain on the show, the fountain garden is amazing. Okay. I feel like I would also choose Highgarden. I feel like I love the Tyrells, which again we have not had time to speak of today, especially in the books. I love the Tyrells and I love their whole, like, I love gardening, I love like the countryside. I think I don't like the heat that much, so I don't think I'd do well in Dawn. Highgarden would be amazing. Definitely not the Vale. I'm terrified of heights.
No.
Yeah, the Vale would be very scary. I think actually also in peacetime, River Run.
Yeah, River Run would be nice. Awesome.
Yeah. I also like urban things. So again, peacetime, I would take the Red Keep. There's a bit of beach, there's a bit of city, like, you know, but I think Highgarden would be like the best one for me. But yeah. So that's really a fun question. We'll wrap up, but in conclusion, that is our extensive discussion that could have probably covered so many more topics, you know, as well. Like I said, like, oh my God, we haven't talked about Tyrion. I love him. We haven't talked about the Tyrells. I'm obsessed with them. But, you know, here we go. We're going into season 8. We're gonna, you know, assume the worst, hope for the best. Any final theories before we wrap up about what might happen on season 8? Like, we're talking show.
Ooh, so many. Ariana, do you have theories?
Everyone will die.
Yeah.
Pretty much that. Well said. Yeah. Exactly.
You know, will Jon ride a dragon? Probably. I mean, he's sort of carried on one. Will he? Yeah. And I think that, yeah, really keen for all of the reunions before everyone dies. I mainly passionately want to see Jaime become the hero that he should be. And all of the other people who are bad to die. But I think some good people will probably also die. But at the end of the day, that's the tragedy of an epic. And I guess that we'll just have to wait to see what really happens in the books whenever that may occur.
Indeed.
Okay. So, yeah, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, you guys.
That's
okay. Everyone listening, please forgive my sans shipping. It's my heart's pure, I promise.
I mean, it's fine. I mean, you don't have to worry about it.
My heart is pure. But this was so fun, and I love talking about all things A Song of Ice and Fire. So thank you for having me.
We will all speak again in various forms soon, but we will say goodbye to everyone tonight. And, so Meredith, good luck with next year. Should that be a thing that you have to worry about in your future after the Supernatural hiatus? I think that it is definitely worth honouring the responsibility of bringing an epic to a close. So,
yes,
you know, our hearts are with you for that. So, yeah. Maybe we'll talk about that next year at this time after we're at the end of that epic. But until then, anyway, we will let everyone go. And hopefully you guys enjoyed Game of Thrones and, you know, you enjoy the final season. And if you haven't read the books, you know, give them a go, because they're long, they're not hard. They are not a dry read. They are very vivid, and it really
sucks you in.
You know, it doesn't feel like reading some sort of like punishment. You know, punishment tome. It's a very lively book. It's why the series works, because these characters are so engaging to read about. And I think it does feed the appreciation of the show to have, you know, to kind of know what's in someone's head while you're watching them doing it on the screen. So until then, you know, live long and prosper, or whatever your house motto is, you know. Winter is definitely coming, and, you know, hopefully some sort of satisfactory survival of at least one good guy happens. But yeah, so long until then, and we'll all say bye. So bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you so much.